Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
At the end of World War II, RAF Coastal Command faced the same challenges of all the British military services, one of reduction, cutbacks, and a return to a peaceful world. The threat from the Axis powers had been effectively squashed, but there was a new threat emerging in the form of the Soviet Union. Coastal Command had to start learning new adversaries again, adapting and performing immediately to protect British interests initially in the Northern Atlantic, but rapidly elsewhere. For almost 60 Cold War years, the RAF relied heavily on two aircraft types through various models, enhancements and sheer longevity, the Avro Shackleton and the Hawker Sydney Nimrod. First flying in 1949, the Shackleton was the first British four-engined aircraft with contra-rotating propellers. It was operated in service for 42 years, retiring in 1991. The Nimrod prototype first flew in 1967 and went on to become a potent anti-submarine, surveillance and air-sea rescue platform, eventually retiring from service 44 years later in June 2011. In 1969, RAF Coastal Command was absorbed into the newly formed RAF Strike Command. Strike Command was later absorbed in the Air Command and more latterly 11 Group. For the purposes of these features, we use the term Coastal Command generically right up until the Nimrod's retirement, a time of Cold War tensions, engagements and flashpoints. In this first Cold War chapter, we speak to author Chris Gibson to help us understand the new challenge for RAF Coastal Command after World War II, as well as all the technology it used to adapt and refine its anti-submarine, anti-ship and air-sea rescue roles. Chris, welcome to Extended.
Oh, thank you.
It's great to have you back. Thank you for joining us. Coastal Command, the end of World War II. What happened to Coastal Command? What was the challenge that it faced given the end of the Second World War?
Coastal Command was probably one of the most high technology aspects of the war that we had seen. The defeat of the U-boats, for a start, had taken an enormous amount of technology, leading to a lot of things we take for granted today, like radio control of various aspects of the war, direction finding, code breaking, encryption. And that had seen the German submarine force completely decimated and negated by late 1943, which enabled D-Day to take place June 1944. Japanese submarines had also been pretty much defeated by 1944, and you would have thought that had shown that submarines weren't the great weapon that they started out the war as, and Coastal Command had played a huge role in that. But the American Navy's submarine force in the Japanese theatre had proved that a naval blockade using submarines was feasible and could be a deadly weapon against the economy of basically a first world country, which Japan was at that time.
Right, okay.
This worried the West because the Soviet Union was becoming a threat from 1945 onwards, and they had acquired a lot of German submarine technology, such as the Type 21 U-boat, and like the British and the Americans, they applied that technology to their submarines. And from that arose a threat against the Western, what became NATO, maritime forces in the Atlantic and beyond. Coastal Command had ended the war with a vast range of different aircraft such as Liberators, B-17s, Catalinas, Sunderlands, Hudsons. And these the American aircraft in there had to be returned or destroyed or scrapped effectively under the Lend-Lease rules, which left the RAF with not much. They hastily brought in the Lancaster as a maritime patrol reconnaissance aircraft and air sea rescue aircraft, and continued on with the Sunderland flying boats. These all needed replacement. But to replace aircraft at that time was quite an involved process. You had to have a specification, an operational requirement, and you had to have somebody to build them at. But you first had to decide what you wanted. And until you knew what you wanted, you couldn't do anything. So having got rid of the American types, the British thought, what are we going to do? We need to replace the Sunderland and we need to replace these Lancasters. So there was a big, big debate going on in Coastal Command about what they should do. Should they persevere with flying boats, replace the Sunderland, or should they carry on with the land planes that they'd been bringing in and had acted so successfully in the Atlantic during the Battle of the Atlantic? Well, they looked at doing both. The Lancasters would be replaced by a type under the specification R546, which would ultimately lead to the Shackleton. But we'll come back to that and we'll look at the flying boats first. Now, I've had a sort of love affair with flying boats ever since I was a little kid, and I got lost at Prestwick Air Show when I was about 4 because I'd been looking for a flying boat. And the Americans had based their flying boats, amphibians really, at Prestwick. So that was me, smitten with flying boats. While the RAF was looking at replacing its Sunderland, they had came up with a very large shorts design called the Shetland. Massive thing, but not very successful. So they decided that that in turn needed replacement, and they drew up requirement R2/48. And this was effectively the Sunderland replacement. And this was to be a new technology flying boat with all the lessons learned from the wartime work, the American experience, etc. And three companies were involved in that: Saunders Roe, Supermarine, and of course, Shorts. Now, this flying boat prompted a huge argument within the air staff. And there was two camps, the pro and the anti flying boat. Now, World War II had seen a massive increase in the number of runways that were being built for airfields around the world. And these could be used for land planes. And these airfields had been built in places where only flying boats had operated before. So the anti-flying boat camp said, forget the flying boats, we'll just go with the land planes. They work fine, we've got the airfields. Good. The pro-flying boat camp said that the flying boats were best for working in areas where you didn't have airfields, like the Far East, and they could also land on water, which they saw as a benefit, but nobody else did. The problem with flying boats was they needed a massive amount of support. The air staff had worked out that to support 18 Sunderlands required 338 boats, fuel scows, armament barges, work platforms, and particularly the work platforms, because if you're working on a flying boat, you drop a spanner, it goes plop, not clank. That's a problem. And they were basically highly intensive aircraft to work on. And then two senior RAF officers got into an argument, probably in the mess. And one of them was the deputy chief of the air staff, Air Marshal Geoffrey Tuttle. And he was of the opinion that flying boats were dangerous, certainly less safe than land planes. And the argument he got into with another senior officer prompted Tuttle to send the director of flight safety to find out if there was a basis for his argument. So he got a hold of Air Commodore Miller, director of flight safety, and told him what he needed, and Miller toddled off and did his work, came back, and sure enough, the number of accidents to flying boats in the final phases of flights, including landings, were much higher than the equivalent number of sorties for land planes. And this pretty much sealed the fate of the flying boat. They were also much more expensive to operate. Not only did they need all the accoutrements, barges, etc., they were the numbers were saying that a land plane was probably two-thirds the cost to operate as a flying boat. And that was pretty much the final nail in the coffin. And that ended the flying boat love affair in the RAF. One senior officer said that the only people that liked flying boats were the old men that loved airships. Because they just loved them.
Yeah. And Chris, just before we carry on there, one of the biggest challenges that Coastal Command faced was the change in the requirements, because a lot of the Second World War aircraft, you know, mentioned, you know, the Liberator, the Sunderland, were very much focused on the German U-boat threat. But the evolving Soviet threat was a little bit different, wasn't it? So how did they square the requirements off the replacement aircraft based upon the challenges they now faced from the Soviet Navy?
Well, the Soviet Navy was moving towards a blue water type fleet. It operated most successfully in the Baltic, doing great damage to German shipping, most famously the Wilhelm Gosloff, which I believe there was about 9,600 people died when it was torpedoed by a Russian submarine. But by the 1950s, the Soviets were moving on. They had submarines with surface launch anti-ship missiles, such as the Shaddock, mounted on a design called the Whiskey Longbin. And then by the 1960s, they had the first submarine launched ballistic missiles on the Golf class. Both of these submarines had to surface to launch their weapons, which made them vulnerable. So you needed an aircraft with a good radar and the ability to attack a surface submarine. And the results of the R546 requirement, the Shackleton, was fitted with a very good radar, and it had plenty of bombs and depth charges to attack. Good heavy payload. Into the 1970s, you had nuclear submarines, which could launch their missiles submerged, and there was also the attack submarines, what they call SSNs, which attempted to follow and interdict the NATO, American and British and French ballistic missile submarines to prevent them. The other problem they had was range. By the time they had these SSNs and SSBNs that could operate in deep water, they moved into the Arctic regions, Norwegian Sea, Barents Sea, and British aircraft would need the range and the endurance to reach those areas from Britain or northern Norway and operate for a useful amount of time on patrol. And that was one of the driving forces behind British maritime patrol aircraft after the war.
And the challenge that the British and the NATO forces held at that time is the Soviet Navy was predominantly, as you say, Baltic and northeast Atlantic based. But with the evolution of the ballistic missile based submarines, it became an Atlantic war again, didn't it? Again, putting pressure on range of aircraft. And the Americans, of course, were becoming under more and more threat as the Soviet technology evolved that pushed them further and further into the Atlantic and closer to the American coast, where they could, of course, eventually launch ballistic missiles against the North American continent. But during that time, there was also an evolution of the detection technologies as well, because at the end of the war, predominantly the technology was based on some radar and the fact that they would have to look for a surfaced submarine. And whilst that continued post-war for Coastal Command, other technologies had to be developed and adopted that would help find these new styles of submarines that eventually could launch submerged.
Well, as you mentioned there, radar was one of the main tools, but it could also be used to pick up, a snorkel being used by a diesel-electric submarine. And some of these radars were amazing, and ultimately probably the best one would be the Searchwater, which was used in Nimrod later in the Cold War. Other techniques included infrared. They had great high hopes for infrared. They thought they should be able to pick up the disturbance in the surface waters of a submarine traveling under the surface by the difference in the thermal signature of disturbed cold water coming from below up to the surface warmer waters.
Yeah.
It did work, but not as good as it could have. So it was kind of set aside for a while. Infrared did come into its own on electro-optical systems later in the Cold War, such as the Sea Owl, which was a British system it was also very handy for finding casualties in water because people are warm and they stood out.
Yeah.
Sonar, that was one of them most secret systems that the NATO allies had. Sonoboys were the main tool of the maritime patrol aircraft. These are like listening devices that dropped into the sea, and they deploy microphones at various depths as required and listen for submarines. They actually date back to the First World War, tail end of the Great War, and were in use during the Second World War. But it was only in the Cold War with miniaturization and much more precise electronics that they came into their own. And the British led the field, as is the Australians, apparently. But they could be dropped in a pattern and triangulate a submarine, and then you would use another technique, possibly the magnetic anomaly detector, to actually find the submarine and then deliver a depth charge on it. The magnetic anomaly detectors, they looked for disturbances in the Earth's magnetic field. A large metallic object like a submarine disturbs the magnetic field, and if you can detect that change in magnetic intensity, you know there's something there. Chances are it's a submarine. Drop a bomb, depth charge on it, and that's that. But I think the main advance is in signal processing of radar and sonar, which allow you to basically build a picture of what you're seeing under the water and on the surface. Like some of these radars, you can actually discern the type of ship that you're looking at. Search water for us is an example of that. And the processing that goes into sonar is just phenomenal. And once computers became miniaturized and they could speed up the processing, they took the lead and they were the primary tool.
Yeah. And one that we maybe skipped over but fascinates me is the Auriculus, is it called?
Auriculus.
I'm fascinated by the explanations you give in the book to that and how I suppose diesel can appear in more than one area, you know, trawlers and things like that, which was a distraction. But I was fascinated by that technology and how it was used.
Well, its origins lay in the Malayan emergency from 1948. And the British wanted to find the terrorist camps under the jungle canopy in Malaya. And they worked out that if they could find their campfires, they could bomb them. So they developed a system that would detect wood smoke. It was a very basic ionization detector, and it would draw in the air containing the wood smoke, carbon particles, etc., detect these, and then zigzag along the trail until it focused on where the source of the wood smoke was. That was your campfire. You could bomb it. That was called Half Garden. And this got picked up by the anti-submarine chaps, and they developed it as Auriculus. And it was designed to detect diesel fumes. But the problem with detecting diesel fumes is you detect any old diesel fumes, and invariably you follow the trail and it turned out to be a trawler. The counter to that argument was that if the Cold War went hot, there wouldn't be many trawlers about, so chances are you'd have a submarine.
Yeah.
But they were pretty much negated by the development of nuclear submarines.
Right, okay. Okay. What about the weaponry that was developed post-war? Because obviously during the end of the Second World War, you know, depth charges were obviously a common threat to submarines. Aircrafts had very basic missiles, and of course there's the traditional dumb bombs, but that technology was aging very quickly, and Coastal Command had to develop, along with the other NATO partners, more sophisticated weaponry to attack the more sophisticated submarines that the Soviets were developing.
Well, by at the end of the war, the Coastal Command was using basically bombs and 3-inch rocket projectiles against submarines and shipping, famously used by the Banff Wing with their bullfighters and Mosquitoes. Into the Cold War, rocket projectiles were still relevant. Things like Red Angel, which was a big rocket projectile, which is about 6 inches in diameter, I think. And ultimately, it came down to guided weapons. Guided weapons and nuclear depth charges, because once the war went hot,
yeah,
go nuclear. That was probably where a nuclear exchange would start at sea. Guided weapons had a against ships, and Britain had a patchy track record. They'd put all their eggs in one basket with a Martell, which turned out to be not very good as an anti-ship weapon, TV guided, and basically once you fired it, the aircraft had to do a 180 turn to guide the missile on a target. And generally, because it was TV guided, you would lose lock when you did the 180 degree turn and lose it.
Yeah.
But
Chris, can I just go back to the nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
I shouldn't have been surprised by that. But again, I was surprised at how early in the Cold War tactical nuclear weapons were adopted and carried on some pretty old aircraft. And I was genuinely surprised that the Shackleton carried nuclear weapons. Could it ever have survived dropping a nuclear weapon and then getting away?
Well, generally these nuclear depth bombs, such as the American Mark 101, the Lulu, which is what the Shackleton would have been carrying, would have been detonated at depth. And if you basically put the Shackleton into a high rate turn, you could be out of the way before it went off. They didn't have a massive yield. They had enough yield to destroy a submarine, because pressure waves, etc., would take it a submarine.
Yeah.
And even helicopters were dropping nuclear depth bombs, like Westland Wessex's. They were dropping the WE-177, as were Westland Wasps. So I don't really see it being much of a problem.
Right, okay. I was just genuinely surprised.
Yeah, that's quite surprising. Something that looks like a Shackleton dropping a nuke.
Or a wasp, for example.
The strange thing about
there's some great pictures as well. Yeah,
you had to take the doors off the wasp. I've heard a couple of reasons for this. One of them was to make it lighter. The other one was to make sure the pressure wave went through the cockpit rather than took out the windows. I don't know whether that's true or not. I don't know why Wessex didn't have that. So other weapons developed was the homing torpedo. Again, these date back longer than you'd expect. Homing torpedoes have their origins, well, at least in the middle of the Second World War. The Germans used a torpedo called the Zaukönig, which bizarrely means wren, as in the little bird. And the British and Americans used what they called the Mark 24 Mine, which was a cover name for an acoustic homing torpedo. And I don't really have any statistics on how successful they were, but possibly by the time that these were in service with the Allied forces, there weren't many German submarines around. After the war, there was a variety of homing torpedoes, such as the Mark 30, which was a British machine called the Dealer B. But the NATO forces used a mixture of American torpedoes, such as the Mark 43, the Mark 44, and the Mark 46. But the main British airborne torpedo was the Stingray, which was a highly capable machine, and that was used on Nimrods. I don't think they can use it on Poseidon yet. I don't think it's been cleared, but probably will be at some point. So, other machines, well, guns, of course, but maritime patrol aircraft have pretty much lost all guns. Shackleton Mark II early versions, they had two 20mm cannons in the nose, basically used for strafing smugglers' boats in the Far East. But since
because,
then,
yeah. Because Coastal Command did have multiple roles. It wasn't only anti-submarine warfare, particularly post-war, wasn't it? It was used across the old, high quotes going on here, across the empire, the receding empire. Coastal Command still had a responsibility in other parts of the world.
Well, they had what they called internal security duties, which was basically bombing the locals when they got obstreperous. And I believe Shackletons were used in Aden for bombing missions as well. But it's mainly out in the Far East that they saw action against smugglers' boats and terrorist camps in Malaya and during the Borneo confrontation of the early 60s.
And then one other requirement was airsea rescue.
Yeah, well, at the end of the war, the RAF had one of the best air sea rescue organisations in the world at the time. Strangely enough, it was pretty much based on work done by one T.E. Lawrence when he was aircraftsman Shaw during the 1930s. And techniques, certainly on fast rescue craft, they owe their origins to Lawrence. But during the war, as more and more air crews came down in water, they needed rescuing, and a lot of the techniques developed at airfields around the country eventually got consolidated into one organization for air sea rescue, and they developed a range of systems for rescuing downed air crew, including an airborne lifeboat, which you could parachute down to a downed crew in their dinghy. And speaking from experience, I would rather be in a lifeboat than a life raft. And I think if I saw a lifeboat being parachuted down towards me, I would make an effort to get into it, because the lifeboats, the airborne lifeboats, also allowed you to make way. They had an engine that could have a range of up to like 600 miles, so you could rescue yourself effectively. And Shackleton's, after the war, they were the requirement called for airborne lifeboats to be fitted to them. That requirement pretty much disappeared around about 1955 when the MR2 came along.
Right, okay.
Basically replaced by Coastal Command's helicopters.
So we've talked through some of the challenges, the Soviet threat, the weapons, the technology that was evolving. How did this then all start to come down to the new operational requirements that eventually led to, in the first instance, to Shackleton?
Shackleton was famously a derivative of the Lancaster. That's the story as it goes, but it was actually more of a Lincoln derivative. Let's just suppose it was a Lancaster derivative. The requirement for the Shackleton was issued in 1946-47. It was called R546, and it was for a maritime patrol aircraft with all the ancillary tasks, air sea rescue, internal security, etc., etc. And there was three versions of the Shackleton built. Mark 1 was pretty much a wartime style maritime patrol aircraft. The Mark II is a much more capable machine, but was very noisy and very uncomfortable. And on a long operation, wouldn't have fancied that. Didn't have very nice facilities for the crew. And that was addressed by the Mark III, which was swapped the tail dragger undercarriage for tricycle undercarriage and fitted two Viper turbojets in the outboard engine nacelles to boost takeoff. Unfortunately, those put so much stress on the airframe, the fatigue life of the Schachten Mark III was limited, and the Mark IIs outlived them by a considerable amount of time, if you include the airborne early warning AEW-2 variant that continued until 1991.
In that early development phase, Chris, until the RAF received the Shackleton, they had some interim measures as well, which included short-term buys from the Americans. Was it P2 Neptunes? They took it an interim buy.
The Neptunes, they're an interesting acquisition because the RAF needed more maritime patrol aircraft because the Soviet threat was getting much greater. So they approached the Americans to get some Neptunes. And the Americans says, yeah, sure, you can have 50 Neptunes. We can provide them under the Mutual Defense Aid Program, MDAP. However, you can't use them for anything but NATO tasks. So you can't use them overseas. You can't use them around your empire to fight your little imperial wars. So the British said, yeah, sure, fine, we'll have them. So they took 50 Neptunes. They sent the Shackletons in the main overseas to do all the Empire work, kept the Neptunes in the UK for NATO work, which is the usual cunning stunts that the RAF and the British government do. Two versions. There's two versions. The earlier P2V4 retained tail turret and all the guns, and the later P2V5, it was fitted with a magnetic anomaly detector in the tail, the big sting that you see on the usual Neptunes. They were also used for airborne early warning trials for the RAF as well.
Okay. Chris, why didn't the RAF at the time buy American for what turned out to be the Shackleton requirement? In the book, you go into a great deal of detail of the various aircraft types that were proposed to the RAF for that requirement, and it was fascinating to see the various types, traditional and non-traditional. But why was the RAF so determined to go for the four-engined, what turned out to be the Shackleton?
Well, they always wanted four engines because they, and this continued right up until the 90s, they did not want a sortie to be abandoned due to one engine failure. If you get four engines, you could carry on with your mission on three. The other main reason for not buying American is that the British economy could not afford the dollar expenditure for buying American kit. They preferred, and plus they had a huge British aviation industry to keep in business. That was always a consideration for whatever. That's why the RAF are equipped with American British aircraft mainly until the 1960s.
Yeah, And it was quite interesting to see what the requirements said for range and endurance as well, because we know from some of the Shackleton's sorties that they would be 12-hour sorties at least, and that requirement for the four engines meant they had a reasonable transit time, but then they could also then switch to a two-engine cruise on station. It was quite interesting to read that.
That came mainly in the later post-Shackleton era with the Nimrod. The speed requirements for transit times were brought about due to the movement of the Soviet threat. The submarines moved into the Barents Sea and the Norwegian Sea. They were further from Britain, so you needed to get to the areas fast. Then you had to spend at least 4, 5, 6 hours on patrol looking for these submarines. So four engines, four jets, essentially. You could move rapidly to your search area, and then as the fuel burned off, you could progressively shut your engines down and do a long patrol and then come back. So
and
very well.
In the pre-production Shackleton, they had what turned out to be a later weight saving issue, and that was the soundproofing. I think it was the MR1. The production models turned up without it as a weight saving exercise, but this is where something you mentioned earlier, some of the crew comfort issues started to become real challenges. And, you know, it wasn't called the Growler for nothing. Those Griffin engines were very, very, very noisy. There was heavy vibration, and it actually led to studies on crew fatigue that eventually led to some real demands to change that and to put some acoustic comfort and better facilities in for the crew in the later models.
Yeah, that would be the MR3. It was supposedly better equipped for crew comfort and to reduce the amount of fatigue. While they were developing the Shackleton, they looked at all sorts of ways of reducing the noise inside. One of them had been borrowed from the Canadian I can't remember the name of the aircraft, but they rerouted the exhausts of its Merlin engines to outboard of each engine to avoid the sound getting onto the fuselage sides and causing reverberation and vibration. But when you get four contraprops running as well, that's quite noisy. Jets really were the way to go.
Yeah, it was certainly described as one of the noisiest aircraft around at the time, as I understand it.
When I lived in Aberdeen in the early 80s, you could always tell when there was a Shackleton in the circuit, because it was always really noisy.
Yeah. And how did the Shackleton, before we go on to talk about the evolution of the replacement for the Shackleton, how did the Shackleton operate in service? Because it seems to have done a pretty decent job given the original demands of it and the longevity that it survived in service.
Well, Avro would say it was a very good design, which it was, given its lineage. I mean, you could trace it all the way back to the Manchester if you liked. But it was a good design. It was well built, and 10,000 rivets flying in formation can't be, there's no mean feat.
And was its longevity partly down to the ongoing discussion, debate, arguments and challenges of its replacement?
Oh, very much so. It soldiered on far longer than it should have.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
So we move on from Chris and his post-war summary, and we look towards the introduction of the Avro Shackleton to learn a bit more about this aircraft and in particular what it was like to fly and operate. In the next chapter, we hear from Ian Chisholm, who was an RAF Air Electronics officer in charge of a team of five senior NCOs who manned the radio, radar and underwater acoustic systems, as well as the 20mm Hispano cannon fitted in the nose turret. They also operated the pyrotechnic launches for the night illumination system. Ian logged over 3,000 hours on various Shackleton types and gives a unique insight into the old grey lady. We hope you enjoyed this chapter on Cold War Coastal Command, and we look forward to you joining us in the next few chapters. Please do leave us a review on your podcast playing app. It might not be something you feel necessarily, but we definitely need your support right now. So don't go away and leave us without your contribution. Otherwise, we lose traction and others cannot find us. So thank you. You can find the extended team on Twitter X, Facebook, Threads and Instagram. With the arrival of the White Hearts and our music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned for future chapters of the Coastal Command story. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.